Heute wird es um den Journalismus als Anker in Zeiten der Krise gehen. Ja, und Krisen, die gibt es leider mehr als genug. Die Klimakrise, Corona, politische Krisen wie die rund um die US-Wahl und den Sturm auf das Kapitol oder auch die in Weißrussland, Myanmar und so weiter. Rassismus, Terrorismus und aktuell auch die militärischen Drohgebaren von Russland an der Grenze zur Ukraine. All das macht einmal mehr deutlich, wie wichtig verlässliche Informationen und seriöser Journalismus sind und wie wichtig es auch ist, dass sich immer wieder unerschrockene Menschen in den Dienst der Sache stellen. In den Dienst von Fakten, aber auch in den von Haltung und journalistischer Verantwortung. Und um einen dieser Menschen, eine der international wohl anerkanntesten und renommiertesten Journalistinnen, da geht es jetzt in diesem Podcast.
This is Media Now, der Podcast der Medientage München.
Mein Name ist Lukas Schöne und ich hoffe, dass ihr trotz der Umstände gerade einige erholsame Ostertage hattet. Für den heutigen Podcast, so kurz nach Ostern, haben wir ein besonderes Gespräch für euch vorbereitet. Bei den Medientagen München im Oktober war Christian Amanpour zu Gast. Sie ist wohl eine der Star-Reporterinnen bei CNN und für den Sender als Chief International Anchor im Einsatz. Wer, wie ich, die US-Wahl im vergangenen November bei CNN verfolgt hat, hat immer wieder die Trailer und Teaser von ihr zwischen der Wahlberichterstattung gesehen, wie sie die mächtigen der Welt interviewt, konsequent und voll bei der Sache oder wie sie in Krisengebieten unterwegs ist. Falls man es bis dahin noch nicht wusste, wurde spätestens dabei klar, sie ist vielleicht das Aushängeschild von CNN. Bei den Medientagen erreichten wir sie in London.
One cannot do on the one hand, on the other hand. The two are not equal. This bit of science that tells you about COVID is not equal to this bit of political propaganda that tells you you shouldn't be doing X, Y, or Z. You have to be absolutely clear about what it is you are providing. And I get very upset about this wrong notion of balance or whatever people want to call it, because whether it's the climate, whether it's COVID, whether it's genocide, no matter what it is, there is also, you know, a line of facts and truth. That's where my road is.
Ja, es wird schon deutlich. Bei dem Gespräch ging es um die großen Fragen des Journalismus. Bei den meisten Krisen heute, ich habe am Anfang ja einige genannt, da ist es eben nicht mehr möglich, zwei Seiten einfach gleichberechtigt gegenüberzustellen. One cannot do on the one hand or the other hand, wie sie sagt. Sie sagt das, weil wir in Zeiten leben, in denen vorwiegend im Netz eigentlich klare Fakten als einfach nur eine Meinung von vielen hingestellt werden, in denen bestimmte wissenschaftliche Erkenntnisse vollkommen willkürlich einer politischen Richtung zugeordnet werden. Menschen machen das, um zu manipulieren, in die Irre zu führen, Propaganda zu betreiben. Und die Aufgabe von Journalismus sollte es sein, das zu erkennen, Lügen auch als Lügen zu bezeichnen. Die Krisen werden immer komplexer, immer undurchsichtiger und es wird immer entscheidender, die Fakten zu erkennen und von Meinungs- und Stimmungsmache zu unterscheiden. Was auf den ersten Blick vielleicht eindeutig erscheint, ist es aber ganz oft nicht. Beispiel aus der Corona-Krise. Viele ExpertInnen äußern sich da, echte und solche, die es gerne wären. JournalistInnen müssen da also herausfiltern. Wer kennt sich womit wirklich aus? Wer hat welches genaue Fachgebiet? Wer stützt seine Aussagen auf was? Und auch, wer hat sich in der Vergangenheit öfter mal geirrt? Wer lag richtig? Kurz, guter Journalismus ist wichtiger denn je. Und was für Christian Amanpour guter Journalismus ist, das hat sie bei den Medientagen 2020 im Gespräch mit Thorsten Zages verraten. Zwar war das schon vor den US-Wahlen im November, aber auch ein halbes Jahr später haben ihre Aussagen natürlich nicht an Aktualität verloren. Es lohnt sich wirklich, da reinzuhören. Deswegen bin ich jetzt auch still. Bis zum nächsten Mal.
Hi, good afternoon. In terms of crisis, some traditional television rules still apply. When we are insecure about what's happening outside, we immediately turn to our television sets, and we especially turn to news television, and anchors are the persons who play an important role. I'm very happy and lucky to be talking to one of the most iconic television anchors and reporters today, Christian Amanpour, who today is CNN's chief international anchor. She's, of course, one of the most iconic journalists, war reporters, and interviewers. Christian is joining us from London, and I'm so glad you're taking the time. Hi, Christian.
Hi there, how are you? Good to be with you.
Good to be with you too. First of all, I mean, you've interviewed so many people, so many world leaders, but also people who are not necessarily the easiest interviewees. Have you in all these years found something like the perfect first question to start an interview?
Oh my goodness, how could you ask me that? No, I haven't. Honestly, it just depends. And I'll tell you, it really depends also on the scenario and on the location. You know, if I'm doing an interview like I'm doing with you, which is what we call down the line and not in person, it's different. You know, you'd probably go straight to the heart of the matter, straight to the subject. If I'm doing an interview maybe with somebody who's sitting right across from me, again, it's a different body language, a different sense of connection. And then, of course, there's different kind of interviews. There's the hard news political, there's the hard news, you know, action, breaking news, whatever's happening. And then there's the cultural. So each one requires a different set. You know, I always try to take a quick pulse of the person who I'm going to be speaking to, just to see, you know, how they're going to be and what their state of mind and body language is in. But that, you know, sometimes takes only a few seconds before I get to start.
Of course, we would all prefer to have you here in Munich, but it's not those times, unfortunately. So I wondered, how do you look at this year, at 2020, where so many people are saying, let's hope this is going to be over soon. It's, of course, the pandemic, but it's more crisis than that. We are talking a lot about climate crisis. We are, unfortunately, still talking about a lot about racist violence all over the world. How do you look at this very special year?
Well, I had hoped 2020 was going to be a special year. You know, I hoped that we were going to turn the corner after a very fractious and difficult 2019. Around the world, that was also a difficult year. Who knew that it was going to get worse and not better? So in a way, you can look at it two ways. It has been a very, very, very difficult year. Started almost from the beginning when, you remember, the United States decided to assassinate a key Iranian military figure. And that sort of put the world on the edge of its seat. Nobody knew whether there was going to be a new Middle East war out of that, what would happen. And then, of course, the pandemic. And yes, many nations, including the United States, here in the UK where I am, were very slow to realize what was going on. And yes, we looked around the rest of the world, your own country, New Zealand, some of the Asian countries, certainly a lot of the European, Northern European and Scandinavian countries seem to be doing, you know, going in so-called, you know, fast and hard and efficient quite early. And so we've been able to, I guess, sort of make comparisons between how this pandemic has been dealt with and what is the consequence in terms of life and death. You know, it's shown the worst of life and the best of life. It's shown how people do, ordinary people can come together, support each other, try to do their best, how, in, you know, enough encouraging ways governments have been able to really do the right thing. But then there's a discouraging. They're the governments who've refused until too late to do the right thing and then continue to do very muddled policy on COVID, very, very muddled indeed. Which is what we're facing here in the UK right now, and it's been going on like that in the United States since the beginning. You've seen even individuals who have sort of fought each other over how best to respond. I mean, the classic example is over masks. And it's very hard to understand that our world has come to this, whereby something like a health crisis has been turned into a political, yet another another political football. And that's very discouraging. We've seen the rise of white supremacy, of course, in the United States, also in your country. It's very alarming to read about how some of these white supremacists have gained rather too heavy a foothold in your country. We've seen the rise of these conspiracy theorists, QAnon, and it's weird that it's erupted in your country as well. It would seem counterintuitive that something like QAnon which is a cult conspiracy theory, US-based mostly, could find, you know, a foothold in a country as rational as Germany. So, you know, this has been a hard year and we're not over yet. And of course, what have we got next week? One of the most important elections of our time, not just for the United States, but for how it will impact the rest of the world.
I'll come back to that QAnon question in a minute. But first, I mean, as a reporter, you've, of course, had a lot of firsthand experience of war, of violence, of suffering. Does that put anything in perspective, what you're seeing right now? Does that make you, I don't know if relaxed is the right word in that context, but does that give you an optimism that in the end it's going to be all right or at least better? Or does that make you rather a pessimist?
Well, you know, personally, the idea of dealing with lockdown and curfews and you know, the sacrifices you have to make as a collective for the greater good, I feel that all the war coverage I've done and having to live in war zones, most notably in Sarajevo during the 4 years of that war, when we were under lockdown and curfew for many hours of the day, when it wasn't a virus, but it was shelling and sniping that attacked civilians and journalists, as well as those on the front lines. I thought that was certainly good training for what we're going through right now. It's different, though, to a war. This is not a war, and some leaders are trying to, or it's not a traditional war. You know, you can't brazen it out just by sounding tough. You know, it's exposed the weaknesses of those countries, for instance, like the United States and the UK, which believe themselves to be exceptional nations. That's certainly what the US believes. And the UK believes itself to have, you know, been able to survive and eventually defeat the Nazis because of its, you know, blitz spirit and its can do, you know, keep calm and carry on. And I think some of those lessons from the past are misplaced. You know, this is something that you can get by being breathed on. It's aerosolized, it's a virus, and we have to be careful. And I feel that, you know, I'm neither optimistic nor pessimistic. I feel that we have to wait and get the science has to play its part. You know, the vaccine trials and good governance. I have to tell you, never has good governance been more required than now, at least not in my lifetime. And you can see the leaders who are doing it right and the leaders who are doing it wrong. And I think that's for me my biggest takeaway. That's my biggest takeaway with all of this. I also believe, as I said before, and I'm speaking as an individual now, not as a journalist, I strongly believe that we should all be wearing our masks when we are in public. We should be keeping our distance when we are inside and in crowded areas. We should be sensible citizens. We cannot treat this as some kind of, you know, assault on our liberty or on our freedom. It makes no sense. It is ridiculous. And so what's depressing and what I am pessimistic about is what's happened to the human community. Now, not everywhere, because in many, many parts of the world, you know, sensible, science-based and good governance policy has and is succeeding. Of course, we're in the middle of a second wave now, but of course, much more is known about the virus and about how it affects people and about, you know, the state of each country's healthcare system and what's required. But I feel that, you know, the notion that we can't all pull together and be sensible is a little bit depressing.
You are an anchor, of course, whom many millions of viewers globally trust and expect some sort of guidance, especially in terms of crisis. How do you balance this, the realm between journalistic responsibility on the one hand, but also something I would call emotional reassurance, if you will, on the other hand? Is that something that you want to provide too?
Yeah, for sure. I would call it a mix of IQ and EQ, you know, intelligence quotient and emotional quotient. And I don't think the two are in conflict at all. I don't think being a journalist and a person are in conflict at all. And you're right. I've spent my entire adult life in conflict, or at least my professional adult life, reporting on conflict, which is both, you know, war and also religious and ethnic conflict, all sorts of societal conflicts that I've covered throughout my career. And I do believe that the bottom line is trust. The bottom line is as people and voters must trust their governments and their scientists and their medical professionals, viewers and, you know, users and, you know, readers and listeners have to be able to trust, you know, the people who they switch on to try to get information from. So I believe that, you know, I, for myself, try to give a intelligent, accurate, science-based, fact-based, community-based view of reality. You know, this isn't a reality show, this is reality. And I think that it's not hard to do that if you have actually spent your whole career doing that. And I absolutely resist and desist from being political about it. And also, most importantly, and I don't know whether you have, you know, young audience members and maybe would-be journalists and the rest listening, but one cannot do on the one hand, on the other hand. The two are not equal. This bit of science that tells you about COVID is not equal to this bit of political propaganda that tells you you shouldn't be doing X, Y, or Z. You have to be absolutely clear about what it is you are providing. And I get very upset about this notion of this wrong notion of balance or whatever people want to call it, because whether it's the climate, whether it's COVID, whether it's genocide, no matter what it is, there is also, you know, a line of facts and truth. And that's where my road is, in the road of facts and truth.
When I said before, many millions of people trust in you, that was, of course, well, an assumption. I'm still pretty sure in your case, of course. But in general, do you think that the institution of a trusted TV anchor is still powerful enough in this day and age to, in the end, be stronger than fake news or conspiracy theories?
Well, I'm not sure, and that's what's also very depressing. If you look at the Edelman Trust Barometer, which comes out annually, and I haven't got the figures in front of me, but you can find out, you know, what is the level of people's trust in the news and in their, you know, traditional, as you say, anchors and journalists and news organizations. This is one thing I would say. Like every brand, and I'm sorry to use that word and that term, news is also has become a brand and a commodity. Therefore, even though it's one of the most important because it's about information and information is power and influence, you have to look for the brand that you know, the brand that you trust, and the brand that has the track record of accuracy and of excellence and of basic, you know, honesty and longevity. And there are many, many, many around. So that's what my challenge to viewers and listeners and you know, internet users and all the rest of it, and readers, don't wimp out. Don't say, oh, I don't know what to believe and I don't know where the truth is, because you can, and it's your responsibility. And you go to whatever trusted brand you know and that has been there for decades and decades and has proved itself. In my case, it's CNN. Here in the UK, it's pretty much the BBC. It's the New York Times. You know, of course, in your country, you have a whole load of excellent media outlets, many of whom I've engaged with, many of whose representatives I've been colleagues with in the field. And I think every single country, certainly the democracies, have, which believe in a free and independent press, has the information that's required, or go on the, in this case, the Johns Hopkins website, or to the CDC, or to the Imperial College, or to, you know, your medical institutions and the Roche Institution and others, you know, you can find the facts. And I think we now have to be, individuals have to be responsible and not just look at social media and get drawn down, you know, rabbit holes of fake news. Donald Trump did not invent fake news. This is just nonsense. Fake news has been around for a long, long time. In the past, it used to be called propaganda. And as you know, it's a tried and tested staple of, in many cases, you know, governments which want to put their view across, usually non-democratic governments, but nonetheless, it is. What Trump says when he says fake news is, I don't like what you're saying about me. It doesn't align with my view of myself and nor my view of politics.
Maybe there I could bring in a question from our viewers, because one of the questions is, why is it so hard to call Trump a liar? Why are a lot of media and journalists always so quote unquote friendly and talk about misinformation instead of calling it obvious lies? Do you have an answer?
It's a good question. I think some are reluctant to use that word, but not others. There are a lot of journalists and a lot of media organizations that call out lies and falsehoods and factual untruths and disinformation and misinformation. But I don't think any more people are afraid of using the word lie. Look, it's a hard word to use, I'll tell you. It is a hard thing for a journalist to say the president is a liar. I mean, you don't expect to have to say that. It's not correct. It's not right that the president is a liar. So it's difficult, but we do say it and we do fact check. And there are whole, as you know, organizations in the United States which are dedicated to fact checking. I mean, there's something like at least 30,000 lies that have been called out on this president since he took office nearly 4 years ago. And it's now we know, though, and now it's no time to be, you know, pussyfooting around, because this is my view. Governments now have life and death on their hands. What they do, what they say causes life or death. And we all need to really understand that and hold governments to account for that. And that's why you're seeing, I mean, I am not going to predict what happens on November 3rd in the United States. But the polls, if you look at the polls and if you look at the general direction of Americans by a vast majority believing the country is in, quote, the wrong direction, it's all about the handling of COVID. And that's because, you know, 220,000 plus people have died because of this disease and because of the way the United States has failed its duty of care and its duty of good governance.
You said before fake news have always been around, which is of course true. The difference is they are more amplified today, amplified by digital platforms and social media. Do you see a danger that journalists and media organizations try to compete with those platforms in a way? Because, I mean, everybody can see that, of course, those gain a lot of traffic. So is it like a challenge for news organization not to give in to that longing for traffic?
I do think it's a challenge. I think you're right. I think what you're referring to is clickbait. And that's, I guess, the technical term for what gets eyeballs. So I think it is a challenge. I'd like to think that most of us are responsible, but I do agree with you. It's a challenge. And I do believe that one of the stupidest things we do is amplify social media and tweets. You know, the truth is that many, many people, many, many more people watch, let's say, I don't know, CNN or the broadcast networks in the United States than are on Twitter. But it's because of the endless repeat and amplification on all the other network or all the other platforms you know, the mainstream media platforms, that they get a much wider distribution. So I think we should stop doing that right now. Everybody should, you know, especially if they're lies and if it's mis and disinformation. Yeah. And even now, you know, you watch the news right now. Even now in the United States, probably here in England as well, they will challenge scientists using talking points that are, you know, from the anti-science, anti-medical, populist wing of life. And we've seen how that happened, you know, during climate, and why the world is so late and why we're in such a desperate existential moment right now. Because for the last, you know, 50 years or more, journalists, as well as everybody else, have fallen into this ridiculous trap of believing that there was an equal scientific reality when it comes to the climate. You know, we have a lot also to be responsible for and to be careful about.
So you referred to QAnon earlier on. Let's take that as an example, maybe. How, according to you, should journalists deal with it? How do you do it yourself? Do you refer to them on your programs? And if so, how do you do it?
Well, to be honest, I haven't yet. I've thought about doing a segment on it, and I've struggled with what's the most responsible way to do it. And it just hasn't yet come up. So I haven't yet done it. However, I also don't know how big a group it is. And I'm actually surprised to see it gaining track overseas and in your country particularly. And I think that, you know, again, it's quite difficult because, as you say, if you amplify these things, I just think you need to do warnings, good housekeeping warnings. This group are a deranged cult. You know, read at your peril. If you want to go down the rabbit hole, you'll find madness at the end of the tunnel. The problem, of course, in the United States is, and this is a problem, I believe that it's mostly amplified and mostly enabled when the top leaders take it on. So in the US, Donald Trump has talked about QAnon and has been very, very, as he normally is, well, I don't know, but I've heard, and they certainly say nice things about me, and they're against pedophilia. What? You know, all this muddle that somehow makes people think that there's something there that should be looked at. So I believe that in many, many instances, leadership comes from the very top and influence comes from the very top. So when you have the people at the very top talking about this stuff, it's a lot more difficult. And I think there's at least one or two in the US, at least people who are trying to run for office, who believe in this nonsense.
And would you have one of the representatives of such a cult on your show? Would you try to confront them?
I think it's a very, very, it's a question that I have not yet fully answered for myself. I don't know. And I tell you what I think, though. I think that in this kind of environment where I can't sit in the same room as them, and when it's just down the line, it's much more difficult. And I think it may be reckless to do so. I think you would have to have maybe, you know, possibly a panel or something, somebody who can absolutely say, well, this guy or this woman says this, but here are the facts and the reality about that. You know, it goes back, you know, yeah, it's rather difficult to deal with. And I think that, you know, I have to think more about it. So far, I haven't done it. And so far, it has not reached a critical mass. I don't think in your country as either. So I'm worried also about overhyping something that might benefit from being overhyped.
Yeah. No, I guess here in Germany, it's still pretty small, of course, much smaller than in the US, but it is there.
Well, how do you deal with it?
Yeah. I mean, you raised that question before. Do you have any explanation why it gains traction and momentum in a country like Germany?
No, I don't. I think there is a, you know, you've still got some vestiges of white supremacy. And that's something that you have to be very careful about in your country, of course, after all the efforts that your nation has made, I mean, heroic efforts since the end of the Second World War. It's an example of democracy that, you know, is quite stunning. I think one has to really be mindful of this and be very careful not to treat it as just yet another idea, you know, yet another avenue of speech. And I'm quite, you know, I think you really have to be able to, and you do that in your country, define what is hate speech and what is free speech, and not be shy about it. You know, you've lived through what happens when you don't make that distinction. And, you know, we are now facing in the West, and this is what's so scary, because, you know, again, I've spent my entire career, you know, not just at war and crises, but in authoritarian, non-democratic and dictatorial regimes. And for me to see authoritarianism creeping westward is very troubling. And I think that really many, many countries should start being very careful about, you know, instituting, you know, civics again and what is democracy. And, you know, there are a lot of young people who have never experienced the devastation of the two world wars and are a long, long way away from that threat to civilization and may not have as big a reverence or respect for the importance and the fragility of democracy that my generation, my mother's and my, you know, and grandparents' generation have. So I think we have to be very careful and not take it for granted.
I think we should take that as a clear warning and appreciate that very much. We also appreciate very much your taking time, Christian, and doing this. It's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much again. And of course, please stay safe.
Thank you very much. Stay safe, stay sane, stay sensible. And everybody needs to think of their community, not just themselves.
That's so true. Thank you so much, Christian, and bye to London. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
This is Media Now, der Podcast der Medientage München.